Okay, welcome all back to this second lecture of the Principles of Banking course. We had kind of a small disaster there in the classroom delta because the computer collapsed there completely, but we will continue online. So this lecture will be also recorded in the normal way through Zoom, and it will be posted to the Moniviestin after tomorrow's lecture, which is the last lecture of this week. So you can go there and have a look at all these lectures through Moniviestin. Regarding the questions and answers, to the chat room there or chat section, I will answer some of the questions at the end of this lecture session, but all of the questions will be answered in text format after the lecture, because I'm going to be recording also those chat questions, and I will answer all of those and distribute the answers and questions through Moodle to all of you. So that's perhaps the most useful way of getting the most of these questions too. But nevertheless, you can also, by opening your microphone, also ask questions during the lecture if you have an urgent need to get some kind of answer to something that is being presented here. So yesterday's lecture, last slide in the yesterday's lecture was about the government dynamic budget constraint. And regarding that theme or thing, I have here the figure regarding the government budget surplus or deficit of the US economy. And it's naturally it's in dollars. So you see that there has been some periods of time just before the change of millennium that the US public budget was actually in a surplus situation. So you see that here. But at the moment, it is going downward very strongly. Notice that this sample period ends to the year 2019. So at the moment, the situation is getting even worse. And we already experienced a phase when we had, in millions of dollars, we had over 1.4 trillion dollars of deficit in the US economy. And currently we don't have the official figures yet, but the forecast is that the deficit is going to be something like 5% in relation to the GDP, which is quite a lot. And the amount of public debt that we actually discussed also yesterday, in terms of this guy here, how does it change in nominal terms between years? You can obviously measure the time period, let's say also in quarterly frequency, but usually we measure this change in years. So within the 1 year's period, how much does the nominal amount of public debt change? This equation determines that thing. So the situation is going to be clearly very bad in the US economy, and the US economy plays now the key role in the survivorship story from this corona situation. So it's getting worse and worse. If we compare this to the European case in the euro area, we have clear targets for the public deficit ratio. It should not be more than 3% per year. And the public debt ratio to GDP should not be more than 60%. So we are now hitting also these targets clearly in each and every euro area country due to the corona crisis. For example, in the Finnish economy, the Ministry of Finance is forecasting at the moment that our deficit ratio will be around 7.5% for this year. So this is clearly a completely different situation compared to anything in the most recent history. Then some ideas about the role of foreign exchange markets. We will not be dealing too much about these things in this course, because you have a separate course on international finance that goes heavily on these things. What is the role of currency markets? And nowadays, the main idea regarding the functioning of central banks is that they should not get too much involved into determining the value of the currency at the moment. But nevertheless, in terms of, for example, foreign trade or international trade, obviously the foreign exchange rates are extremely important things. And you will be get to be introduced to these things more in the international finance course. But all of you understand what is the idea of foreign currency markets and foreign exchange rate. It's the price of the one currency in terms of the other currencies. And there are lots of partial equilibrium relationships between the country valuation regarding, for example, the role of interest rates in determining the future changes in foreign exchange values. And you will get to be introduced to those also in the course on international finance. Why study international finance? One reason is that the central banks are thought to have a role in enhancing the general aggregate economic performance in economies, but the international financial markets have a huge role there in terms of, for example, speculation against certain currencies in some countries. So choices regarding exchange rate policy and capital controls, for example, are very important in this respect in each country. And in previous years, for example, the role of IMF, International Monetary Foundation, or International Monetary Fund, actually played quite a big role, for example, when we tried to cope with the outcome of the global financial crisis, especially for the part of some countries that completely collapsed, like the Irish case, for example, after 2008 crisis, the IMF rescue packages for funding those economies played a huge role there. So these institutions actually have a big word to say in this functioning of these international financial markets. So here's the quotation for the exchange rate of the US dollar. We usually use this trade-weighted US dollar index or any other currency indexes against other major trading partners of that currency that we are discussing about. So this is the so-called effective exchange rate, where we have the trade weights of each and every currency regarding against the US economy taken into account when we calculate the value of this basket of currency quotations against the US dollar. Okay, one of the key issues is that the international financial system has become much more integrated throughout the world. So there are lots of things that you have to understand. And these money, banking, and financial markets, main concepts of these things should be known to you if you want to, let's say, be a successful expert in financial markets. You have to understand nowadays, especially the role of monetary policy. What is the role of monetary policy decisions in determining, for example, the future path of certain interest rates? How are the interest rates at different maturities connected to each other? What are the key factors that determine the country level interest rates at various maturities? These are the things that you will be taught in this course. And what's the role of banks here in this financial intermediation process? How are they managed? And what are the key incentives in the working of the bank as a firm. So we will basically study everything using this idea of demand and supply. So the concept of equilibrium will be playing the biggest role in all of our discussions in theoretical terms. We want to analyze what are the reasons for excess demand or excess supply for funds in the markets, for example, for interest-yielding asset markets, and how should we cope with those situations? Which is the agent in the economy that should be reacting to these things? And what is the main variable that is going to be adapting to this disequilibrium situation in the markets? So it's the price of that asset. And prices and interest rates are in a negative connection. I will introduce that idea to you in more details fairly shortly. Aggregate output and income are one of the key components or one of the key concepts that you have to understand. What do they mean? How are they calculated? The gross domestic product, GDP, is the market value of all final goods and services produced in a country during a course of a year, which means that it's a flow measure during some period of time. You can measure that also in quarterly intervals, but in most cases, the annual changes are the ones that we are interested about. Aggregate income by definition means the total income of factors of production, and the factors of production are land, labor, and capital from producing goods and services in the economy over the course of the year. And that should be equal to aggregate output. Then another set of key measures that you have to understand, that you have to always, as an economist, you have to be able to make a distinction between nominal values, which mean the current price values of things, and the real values. When you want to measure something in real values, you have to first determine the so-called base year, to which values you want to compare, for example, the current values. So that would be something that cleans up basically the effect of price changes, meaning inflation. So usually, for example, we choose the base year in 5 years intervals. For example, in GDP measures, currently we are using actually 2015 as the base year. And also for the consumer price index, we are using 2015, but it changes usually within 5 years or after 5 years. Then aggregate price level, as mentioned already in several occasions here in the course, you can measure that in various ways. Basically in economics, we use these three measures, the GDP deflator, which is related to all the items that are being calculated by the national statistical offices to the national GDP, gross domestic product. What is the price of each and every component in GDP? So it's a weighted value. It's an index figure also. Then PCE is personal consumption expenditures. So it's a bit different thing. The national statistical institutions organize every 5 years a questionnaire where they want to know the standard expenditure portfolio of consumers. It's fairly almost analogous to this consumer price index. Consumer price index is the one that is being most frequently actually followed in the standard media, because you can observe that at monthly frequency. So main difference between these three measures as an economist for you comes from your need to use that variable in your analysis. Are you interested about the longer term developments, then use probably the GDP deflator, or are you interested, for example, the variation within 1 year or 2 years periods of time, then use the consumer price index, because you can calculate that in monthly frequency. Then, function of financial markets is the thing that can be captured actually based on this flow of funds idea of indirect finance and direct finance. So basically, if a standard layman comes to you and asks from you the meaning of the banking sector, you should be able to explain that the banking sector is the one that can make the most use of the information regarding the individual agents, households and firms and other agents in the economy, regarding the transmission process of the excess of funds. So we have these four sectors in the aggregate economy. We have households, we have business firms, we have government and foreigners. They can be either excess fund holders or they might be in need for funding. The same set of agents are here in both sides. And funding can go through direct finance sources or direct finance, which means that funding can go through financial markets in the form of shares of stocks, common stocks, or bonds, or money market funds. So the main thing there is that the traditional banks are not there. They are not being used as the collector of information regarding who is in need for funding and which are the ones that are able to supply funding. If you go to a bank office and want to have a loan there, so you are in need for funding, and then you are using this indirect route of financing. So the banking sector in overall terms here is constituting this indirect sector, and the financial markets are constituting this one. And the rough classification, when you compare, for example, countries that are said to be more market-oriented in their financing sources compared to bank-oriented, is based on the role of stock markets. Nowadays, we have also more sophisticated measures for this development index of financial markets, so it includes various forms of sources or financial market actors or players, not just the stock market, but in, let's say, 10, 15 years ago, the main distinction between market-based and bank-based was the role of stock markets in relative terms in the funding processes. So, what is the structure of financial markets? We can talk about debt and equity markets. The main factor behind the pricing of these debt instruments is the maturity. How long does it take in time perspective to get the funds back from your investment if you want to have those back? And then the equities are a bit different thing, because originally they are meant to be, equity markets are meant to be long for long-term financing needs of firms. And the main factor that determines the willingness of the investors to participate into equity markets is the promise of dividends that the firms can pay. And that is dependent on the real economic performance of the firms, how well are they doing in terms of profits. Dividends are the residual income part of all the profits. Then we can also discuss about primary and secondary markets, which means that usually when firms want to have funding for their real investment projects. They want to build up a factory, for example. They can issue notes, various forms of primary market investment assets. And usually the investment banks are the ones that underwrite these securities in primary markets. So they act on behalf of the firms that are in need for funding for their real investment processes and sell those securities to the investors that are interested in investing to them, that firm. And then the thing that gets the most attention in the public media is obviously the secondary markets, because there we have the price quotations and return quotations for various securities, and brokers and dealers determine basically based on simple supply and demand ideas and the idea of equilibrium in the markets. They basically determine the price quotations and hence also the returns in the secondary markets. And these are the ones that you usually follow in the financial press, for example. We get quotations for the general price index in the stock markets and individual firms, and they are based on secondary market quotations. Then we can also make a distinction between the exchanges and OTC markets. OTC markets are markets that do not have a physical place. They are completely electronic form of funds transmission or investments. And these exchanges have a physical place where the actions take place. But they also use these electronic platforms for trading, actually. Then as a phenomenon that is most important for this course is the distinction between the money markets and capital markets. Money markets, by definition, are short-term debt instrument markets, which means that the maturity of all the assets traded is below 1 year. The maximum is 1 year. And then capital markets are for the assets that have a maturity that is over 1 year. So all that is traded in longer term asset markets is denoted to be capital market activity. And equity instruments are actually also, in theoretical terms, classified to be long-term investment assets. So they are denoted to be one part of capital markets. Here's a figure here's a figure about the extension of the various forms of these money market instruments or the sections of money markets. And you can see here that, for example, the T-bill market, the treasury bill market, should contain the least default premium. In the US economy, have expanded since 2000 in huge amounts. So, and also another thing that you are able to see here that the commercial paper market that refers to the debt instruments at below 1 year maturity for firms has been actually decreasing. But the latest figures actually from the US market actually are also pointing towards a situation where this number is now increasing again. But the fence funds trading with the federal funds and security repurchase agreements is the one that refers to the first steps of these unconventional monetary policy actions. And the amount of these increased a lot after the 2008 crisis. You see here over threefold extension compared to the figures at the start of millennium in 2010. So these are the instruments that are being used in the unconventional monetary policy actions in the form of purchase programs. And then if we go to the longer term instruments, which means that the definition here is that we are focusing on the instruments that have a maturity over 1 year, then obviously corporate stock market plays a big role in the US economy. It's very much a market-oriented economy compared to some of the euro area countries, for example. Mortgage market means housing loans. Well, they have stayed pretty much the same after the 2010. But for example, the bank commercial loans have increased quite a lot here. So the main idea here is just for you to understand that we are talking about the longer term capital market instruments in this case. Then there are various forms of international assets forms of international investments. You can invest in foreign bonds nowadays also. You can buy euro bonds or you can buy euro currencies, which just means that, for example, you deposit a US dollar denominated deposit to a bank in foreign country outside the US or in foreign branches of the US banks. And it's also nowadays for each and every one of you, it's also nowadays very easy to participate to the world stock markets through your bank, for example. So you can buy various forms of international index funds, for example, that are investing on the world markets. So everything is connected to each other at the moment, because due to this internationalization of financial markets. So what's the main idea in the functioning of financial intermediaries? So we are now focusing on the part of indirect finance section in that figure that we discussed about. The main idea is that it enables economies of scale to perform a large scale loan issuances, for example. And it provides also liquidity services for the general public, households and firms especially. And also the banking sector ideally should reduce the exposure of investors to risk. So it enables risk sharing between various assets. So there's possibilities to maturity transformation, for example. So you can combine a set of short-term deposits to one individual item to be given as a loan, longer-term loan to a customer that is in need for funding. And it also gives you the possibility to use the diversification of your asset portfolios. So they have a big role. And the main idea could be classified to be actually in terms of this having an effect on dealing with the problems stemming from asymmetric information in the markets. And in economics jargon, we usually classify these problems regarding asymmetric information to adverse selection, which means that there is some information disadvantage for some of the participants or the participants in the markets before the transaction. So as a banker, you try to avoid selecting the risky borrower by gathering information about them. And then the second classification is in terms of moral hazard, which means that after the transaction, you should be able to ensure as a banker that the borrower will not use the funds in activities that have not originally been denoted to be used. So, for example, as a banker, if you issue a mortgage or a housing loan to a household, how you should be able to monitor that it's not going to be used for buying a car, for example. So it might be something that also the regulator has a role to play. How are the banks able to monitor the behavior of the customers after the transaction of funds has been accomplished? So you can sign a contract with restrictive covenants for the uses of the funds that the bank has issued. So in general, we can say that the role of the banking sector is to serve as an enabler of the small savers and borrowers to benefit from the existence of financial markets. Okay, so there are lots of financial intermediaries in the markets, and this classification is basically based on the US classification. We have commercial banks, for example. In the Finnish markets, we denote the Nordea and Danske Bank to be the main representatives of the commercial banks. But the primary liabilities, the things that the bank is willing to sell to the customers, are deposits. And the primary assets, the things that the bank is going to get return from. So these are the things that the banks have to usually pay something. They pay interest rate on the deposits. And these are the things that the banks usually want to get return. So they are assets. And they are liabilities. So this actually gives you the first idea about what is the actual production machine of banks. It's simply the balance sheet of the financial intermediary or the banking firm. So it's about optimizing the amount of assets in terms of getting the maximum possible return from those in relation to the sources of funds that usually are the deposits in the banking sector. And in the Finnish economy, for example, these savings and loan associations, where you can actually also denote the Finnish OP Group to be one member of these kind of banks, are playing a big role, because the OP Group now plays, for example, it has a 40% market share of the consumer loans, for example. By the way, I have downloaded the 2019 annual reports of both the Nordea and the OP Group to the Moodle website, so you can take a look at there, especially in terms of having a view on how different can the annual reports be between the banks. There are some certain things that they have to report based on the supervisory authorities. But for example, if you take a look at those reports, they look very different from each other. So it's not so easy to find the main figures, for example, from those reports, but you are able to do that. And they are reporting all the things that the regulatory institutions or the financial supervisors are requiring them to report. But take a look at those through Moodle. So, then we have here these other funds and intermediaries, like life insurance companies and fire and casualty insurance companies and pension funds, for example. For example, in Finland, pension funds play a big role in our domestic financial markets as an institutional investors. For example, the Varma, which is one of our pension funds, holds at the moment approximately 45 billion euros of assets at the moment. I think it's approximately that scale. So they are huge players in the markets in general. But nevertheless, if you take a look at what kind of assets are the various financial intermediaries using, and what are their liabilities. So basically, when you go from the first page of this table three towards the last table, the main distinction between these things is that these are more and more market-oriented institutions. So, for example, these hedge funds are nowadays a very popular form of investments. and their primary assets constitute from stocks, bonds, loans, foreign currencies, and many other assets like commodity market assets, for example. So they are basically nowadays one form of very risky investment possibilities, and their primary liabilities are in the form of partnership participation. So you can buy a share or buy a part of this fund, and also these mutual funds and money market mutual funds actually play in the same markets in terms of their assets, and you can buy shares of those and invest into these assets through those companies. Okay, so what are the roles of these various forms of financial intermediaries in market valuation, in terms of market valuation? So you can see that commercial banking sector has been increasing all the time, even though some parts of alternative financial investments have been emerging also. But still, the commercial banking sector is increasing all the time, quite a lot. Life insurance companies have also increased quite a lot. Pension funds are important in the US markets, especially. And local government retirement funds are there also important. But here you can see actually the tremendous popularity of these mutual funds, for example. And there are lots of research going on about the characteristics of the mutual fund traders, for example. What are the things that determine the optimal returns in relation to the risk profiles, also from investments in mutual funds. And it is important research because the role of those funds has increased quite a lot in the US economy, especially. Okay, so you can take a look at the latest development of these figures also through this link to the Federal Reserve databases. Then some words about this online alternative finance forums. There are, have been lots of discussions in the public press or media about the role of these online alternative finance sources. And I have here some slides about this because it has been denoted to be an important form of funding or financial market sectors, especially to the emerging economies, where the deregulation of these this sector has not been so strong previously. But it has been actually increasing. So when you think the concept of alternative finance, this information is taken from the one of the reliable sources for information regarding this alternative finance forums, that is from the Cambridge Center for the Alternative Finance in Judge Business School and also Chicago Booth School of Business. And there the researchers have classified that it's actually, we have two meanings for this online alternative finance sector. Investment bankers would like to think those sources as non-traditional asset classes. So it's more like related to the investment behavior or speculative behavior in the markets. And they are denoted to be alternatives to stocks and bonds in that sense. And private placement of corporate debt is funded by institutional investors instead of banks. So the banking, traditional banking sector is not involved in this. But economists actually want to think alternative finance as a source of financing and payment channels that address the needs of individuals and businesses in economies that do not have a very well-functioning, normal financial or banking system. So this has been especially important, for example, for African countries that seem to have been experiencing some lacks in the development of the banking sector, for example. So this material is from the Cambridge Center for Alternative Finance. Some of you want to do more analysis or research on these themes. That is a reliable source for more information. And I have also downloaded the first global report regarding this sector of financial markets to the Moodle site, so you can take a look at that. There are lots of firms involved in these reports, and also, for example, some Norwegian business schools are now focusing on these things. But it's actually something that is only emerging in terms of overall volumes of the markets at the moment. So the main idea in the by the definition of the Cambridge and Chicago Booth School is that they are instruments and channels of finance that originally emerged outside of the regulated banking system in both developed and developing economies. But for the part of regulation, for example, in Finland, these markets have been regulated mildly from 2016. And since that, the role of these markets actually has decreased. You can take a look at the individual country level characteristics and development, most recent development also from that report that I've downloaded to the Moodle site. But the main idea is here to make a clear distinction between the various types of these sources of alternative finance on the basis of the source of financing, use of proceeds provided by the financing, and the instrument used to provide the finance. So here's a bit blurry slide on what kind of terminology we are using here. The main classification that is now different from the previous reports in that report is that you can now classify these forms of financing to based on the debt idea of debt instruments. So we have these debt models. The main thing here is that the funding is issued in the form of a debt agreement between the participants in this trade. So peer-to-peer, P2P means peer-to-peer or marketplace lending. And it's classified into consumer lending, business lending, and property lending. And there's the description of the stakeholders there. And then the balance sheet lending is one form of debt funding in these markets. Invoice trading is something. And also you can trade securities that are in the form of debt, mini bonds and debt-based securities. So here are the explanations, which are the stakeholders in these individual cases. And then the other classification is based on equity or ownership rights that this form of funding gives. So in each of these forms of business model, we are involved with ownership of that. In this case, these do not basically involve very much ownership, except for the part of these securities that are in the form of debt also. But here, the ownership is much more important. So you can get a share of the firm that is in need for funding through these markets. So we can have equity-based crowdfunding for certain purposes. So there are individuals or institutional funders that purchase equity issued by a company. Then real estate crowdfunding, profit sharing, and in non-investment-based cases, we have this reward-based crowdfunding. These are new definitions that changed in 2017, actually. So this is very much a developing part of financial markets in overall terms. So what is the general, let's say, meaning or the role of these markets? You will be given much more details about these because all these forms of financing here, alternative financing, are using these platform platforms for actual trading. So Dennis will be discussing about the role of these forms in more details and what has been especially the role of China in there. But you see from these figures that in terms of the total volumes of these markets, if we take all the global alternative finance volumes together and calculate the volumes, we have only $305 billion of market value in overall terms. And that includes China. And because in Chinese markets, the regulation increased quite a lot. The local regulatory authorities in China sort of woke up to this segment of financial markets that it's perhaps worth to be supervised a bit more closely. And that step actually, or that waking up, caused a wave of bankruptcies for these platforms for 2018. So that is the reason why actually, when you include the Chinese numbers to the total volume, the number has decreased almost, what's the percentage changed there? 25% at least. But in other parts of the world, or the global financial markets, we see that it has still been increasing. But this more or less emphasizes the role of regulation in these markets. If the regulator decides to intervene strongly to the alternative finance markets, they will basically collapse. And Dennis will be discussing more about these things also. So if you compare, for example, these actual volumes, compare this, I just checked from the actual Nordea and OP annual reports that, for example, in Nordea, the amount of total assets in the whole of Nordea, which is a Nordic bank, not only it's operating the head offices is at the is in Finland at the moment, but it's a Nordic bank, as you most of you actually know. The amount of assets, total assets in the Nordea balance sheet 2019 was 555 billion euros. So compare that to, for example, this 419 billion US dollars. So already one individual big bank in Nordic countries had more, clearly more assets than the overall alternative finance market valuation was in 2018, especially in 2018. And also in for the part of OP Group, that is the second big bank in Finland, their amount of loans to the public was 92 billion euros in 2019, at the end of 2019. So compared to this, it's almost one third of this global volume of alternative finance markets. And when you remember that the OP Group was only the 50th largest bank in the whole of Europe in 2018, for example. So this is like peanuts compared to the traditional banking sector globally. So it has been increasing due to these technological advantages quite a lot in recent years, but it will probably not overcome the traditional banking sector, at least not in the near future. But obviously, it might be the case that it's also useful for the traditional banks to get involved to these markets or these platforms in much more details and develop their own platforms for these purposes. It might be the next step that many of the banks are taking at the moment. But nevertheless, Dennis will be discussing more about these alternative firms of digital finance, basically alternative finance, financial markets. Okay, so here's another slide still about the volume of these business models. When you want, so you just, this is just to highlight that the peer-to-peer market, or the peer-to-peer model is the most significant by far from all the business models in the alternative finance markets. Okay. So let's go back to basics again. In the public discussions, people often confuse or get mixed three main concepts in from the point of view of an economist regarding money, finance, wealth, and so on. So you have to be very precise on these definitions right from the beginning. You have to understand what is the meaning of money, because that's very much related to the idea of money supply and what role does the money supply have in, for example, monetary policy actions. So in general terms, this is an economics definition. Money can be denoted to be anything that is generally accepted as a payment for goods or services or in the repayment of debts. That's a very general definition for money. And it's a stock concept. What does a stock concept mean? It's not referring to the public quotations of shares of stocks of firms. It's referring to the measurement of that value of money. When do you want, or within what time period you want to measure that? A stock concept means that you are only able to measure that at a certain point of time. At the end of week, at the end of month, at the end of 3 months, quarterly period, at the end of year. That is a stock concept. You get it from the balance sheet. What is the situation at the year of the time, at that year that you are discussing about? Then, wealth is a completely different thing. It's a total collection of pieces of property that serve to store value. Wealth comes in various forms. You can have forests in your portfolio. You can have stock, shares of stocks in your portfolio. You can have bonds in your portfolio. You can have derivatives in your portfolio. You can have a house in your portfolio. That is, those are the parts of wealth, examples of those. Then income is, again, different concept. It's a flow of earnings per unit of time. So it's very much a flow concept. So money is a wealth concept. Stock concept. Wealth is a stock concept, but income is a flow concept. Everything can be measured in currency terms, but they are, by definition, measuring a bit different things. You have to be careful in this. So, what are the functions of money? The traditional main purpose of having any money in your holdings is that it serves for you as a medium of exchange. So it eliminates the trouble of finding a double coincidence of needs. This is once again an economics term. And the main idea for that is that it reduces transaction costs. And then it also promotes specialization of, for example, labor force. You can work in some professions and earn salary from that is measured in a common currency, and you can use the proceeds of those earnings through medium of exchange service of money, because you can buy things with your earnings when you use money, regardless of whether the money is in electronic form or in plain cash or coins. The same thing. It's designed to be serving as a medium of exchange. So it must be easily standardized, widely accepted, divisible, and easy to carry, and not deteriorate in physical terms or in financial terms very quickly. One of the important things that it should not be deteriorating in financial terms, which means in value very quickly either, and not in physical terms. The other function of money is that it should be able to be used as a unit of account. It's used to measure values, all the values in the economy, so you can compare different things to each other. It also reduces transaction costs through this channel. It also stores as a store of value, so you can use that to save purchasing power over time, assuming that the value of money doesn't change in time too much. And the value of money, how much does it change in terms of the purchasing power, is dependent on the inflation rate, the general aggregate level of prices. And the other assets also serve this function to storing the value. Money is the most liquid of all assets, but loses value during inflation. So in terms of investing to some other assets, it should be possible for you to make the comparison between the benefits from investing to that asset in terms of the easiness of transforming those proceeds from those investments to money, plain money, because you can use the money for your consumption purposes. It's not easy, so easy to use the proceeds of your investments to shares of stocks, for example, that are publicly quoted, because there's a time when you only are able to utilize all the proceeds when you sell those. Money is there in your hands immediately, so you can use that for your purchasing purposes or consumption purposes. And the evolution of the payment system has started from the commodity money, actually. During, for example, the gold standard, the value of money was connected to the gold, value of gold. And the reason for that was that it was easy to value, it was easy to standardize, and it was easy to divide it between commodities, but not perhaps so easy to carry, for example, gold in your pockets. So that actually gave the reason to develop this fiat money system, which means that we have for a long time been using paper money, which is decreed by the governments as a legal tender and the single authorities that are authorized to print money are the central banks. No one else can print paper money, which means that we have this system of fiat money. The single authority is the central bank that is allowed to print any money. Then the development of or evolution of this payment system is obviously important. Originally, we have had these check systems. It is not so common anymore because electronic payments have increased their importance. Nowadays, we have primarily, we are using these electronic forms of money like debit cards and stored value cards and e-cash in our everyday transactions. And for example, during the corona crisis, the demand for plain cash in Finland, for example, decreased quite a lot because during the corona crisis, the plain cash is being treated as a something that can spread the disease because people are handling the cash. So it's not preferable to use cash nowadays at the moment very much. So many of the for example, restaurants, for example, here at the University of Jyväskylä, we have one restaurant that is not accepting money at all, or plain cash in the form of notes and coins as a payment to lunch. So you have to use always some form of electronic money, like debit card, when you go and buy a lunch there in this restaurant. Are we heading towards a cashless society? The simple answer is that basically, we might be heading towards less and less usage of notes and coins but not completely cashless society. Because there are clearly there are problems in using these electronic forms of money. And for example, in Finland, the OP and Nordea customers experienced the latest example of these problems during the weekend because for a certain period of time, it was not possible to use your cards at all, electronic payment cards at all, because the system updates were there going on in both of these banks at the same time. So there are obviously problems in these two. So the forecasts among the central bankers are sharing a common view that the cash will not completely be vanished from the societies in the near, very near-term future, but let's say in 10 years' time, it might be a different situation. Electronic money will likely still increase in the future. What about these cryptocurrencies? What is their role? You can take a look at this Bitcoin, for example. What is the idea? Most of you probably know the idea of Bitcoin. But one of the problems regarding the heavy uses of currencies that are in crypto form is connected to their energy needs. For example, trading in Bitcoins requires huge amounts of computer power. So it's one of the disadvantages at the moment, and it's also been under strong speculative attacks during the downturns in economies and also during the financial crisis. And there is a very nice paper on the role of these currencies, cryptocurrencies, written by Corbett and others in this Economics Letters publication from 2018. I will give you other papers also on the role of cryptocurrencies, because that's going to be one of the home assignments themes. But it's not so, let's say, it's not so relevant in terms of the general understanding of the financial system at the moment, because the central banks are not at the moment accepting these current forms of cryptocurrencies as a medium of exchange in overall economic actions. So in the future, when the central banks will be accepting those and they will be issuing their own forms of cryptocurrencies or electronic money, the situation will completely change. Because after they have accepted those forms as a general medium of exchange, then they are also strongly focusing on the value of those assets. So they are defending the price development. They shouldn't be too volatile in terms of price quotations, and the central banks will be doing their best to stabilize their price development. At that stage, probably these cryptocurrencies issued by the central banks will play a bigger role. We will see that in the near future. There have been a lot of discussions in the Riksbank, which is the central bank of Sweden, about going towards a electronic money in the Swedish economy in the near future. So how do we measure money? These are the standard measures or concepts that we still use in this analysis. We start from the idea that we have to construct some kind of aggregates based on the balance sheet items that the banks have. So the central banks have the knowledge or information about, almost daily information about these items in the bank's balance sheets, updated, and at least the monthly values of these are publicly are published in their websites. And the starting from this is to start everything from the definition of M1, which means that you take into account only the most liquid forms of funds or assets. So you add together the amount of currencies, travelers checks, demand deposits, and other checkable deposits from the each and every one, every bank of your country. So each central bank is in charge of calculating these things from the bank's balance sheets. If we move on to the more broader aggregates of money, then this M2 is actually something that the policymakers are focusing on. The central bankers are mostly focusing on in normal times for the to the development of M2. So it adds up the amount of M1 plus small denomination time deposits and savings deposits at, and money market deposit accounts plus money market mutual fund shares. So the main thing here is about the maturity of these items. So all the items included to the measure M2 in money are below 1 year maturity. That is the money market maturity. When you calculate these as of July the 3rd, as an example, for the US economy in 2017, you get the actual amount of money in the economy in certain point of time. You can get the total amount of M1 and add in all the items in M2 to the amount of M1, you get the amount of M2. And this is the one that the central bankers in normal times usually focus quite a lot. And if you add the other longer term items from the bank's balance sheets to these M1 and M2, then you get the M3 measure. This is now referring already to the items that are denoted to be funds or market assets in capital markets. So they are with a maturity that is longer than 1 year. Everything that is longer than 1 year. So it includes M1 and M2, and then adds to these values all the items that are included to bank balances with a maturity over 1 year. Usually, larger aggregates than M3 are even not existing. And in current situations, actually, these definitions have to be reformulated in textbook presentations in the future, because it might be the case that actually, due to these unconventional monetary policy actions, the central banks are extending the measures of money, aggregate level measures of money. It might be actually the case that in M3, by definition, in the near future, you also include permanently the amount of certain government assets with longer term maturity, and also some of the firm sector loans. But that is something that is being discussed amongst the central bankers quite heavily at the moment, because the current situation should not be the new norm. They are not interested about declaring that the current system of and the role of unconventional monetary policy action should be so strong that than it is at the moment. So, does it matter which measure of money you are considering? It's actually the case, it has been the case that due to the technical development of the payment systems, it can be the case that M1 and M2 actually are moving in different directions in the short run. So the choice of monetary aggregate is very important for you as a policymaker. Then what is the role of actual plain cash in nowadays economies? And compared to the, for example, the European case, the U.S. citizens in 2018 held actually quite a big amount of actual currency cash in their portfolios or wallets. It was $4,500 on average. So it's a very big number actually, in the form of plain currency. So what is the explanation for this? It might be actually that at least in early days, the black markets played a big role in terms of the actual currency amounts. So criminals and foreigners imposed a big demand on these actual cash holdings. But this actually has decreased also among these. Nowadays, the foreigners, usually when you go nowadays abroad, after you are once again allowed to go abroad, you will usually not carry too much cash, even in the US case. But for example, when I go to the US, I usually want to have some cash, because surprisingly often there are places that at least last year when I last visited the US didn't accept any other forms than just cash. But this is also the amount of aggregate or the average amount of the actual currency holdings or cash holdings is also decreasing in the US economy at the moment. But here's an example, a historical figure up until 2017 about the development of these M1 and M2 measures. And as you see, they can go actually to opposite directions in some certain stages. In many occasions, they go in the same directions, but actually there are some occasions where the numbers of M1, so this can be connected to some kind of hoarding of cash holdings of some sectors of economy. For some reason, people wanted to have more cash at the early 1990s in US economy, and that was actually in connection to the situation in the aggregate price level. So inflation situation was such that people wanted to have more cash in their hands because prices were increasing all the time. And then actually the US Central Bank, Federal Reserve at that time engaged into heavy actions towards lowering the money supply and increasing the interest rates to stop the development of the general inflation. So they can occasionally, M1 and M2 can go to different directions. But usually the trend-like behavior between these two items is pretty much the same. M2 doesn't vary so much as M1, and that is one of the reasons why the central banks want to focus on the development of M2. It's not so volatile compared to M1. Okay, then, how do you measure interest rates? What is the main idea of interest rate calculations? And this is actually one of the main important concepts that you have to understand in this course. The idea of present value. A dollar paid to you 1 year not from now is less valuable than a dollar paid to you today. That is the simple idea of discounting, which means that we assume that the consumers would like to consume now more than perhaps in the future. So if you suppose that the consumer is assumed to give up some of his or her consumption at the moment, she or he would have to be given some kind of reward for that. And that reward has, in normal times, been the positive interest rate on savings. The savings are the residual income that you are not using for consumption purposes. So A dollar deposited today can earn interest and become more than $1 in the future. That is the main idea. So here we are assuming all the time that the main idea in discounting behavior should be based on the idea of positive interest rate. And this is something that is confusing the economic models, theories that we use even nowadays to model the behavior of aggregate economies and individual consumers and firms also. So, but nevertheless, we would still like to be assuming that consumers or households want to consume if they are given the possibility to consume now or later without any reward for saving from your incomes today, then they would prefer consuming now. That is the main idea. So to understand this, let's consider a $20 million lottery payout today versus a payment of $1 million per year for each of the next 20 years. So we are considering the same amount, basically, just distributed in smaller parts, distributed in 20 parts compared to the 20 million getting right now. Are these two values the same? So let's assume a very high interest rate. So this is very, let's say, contractual example. We are assuming an interest rate of 10% in annual terms. So within 1 year's time, you get $110 from your investment. And within 2 years' time, you get, based on the idea of getting interest also to your interest yield from the previous year in this discounting idea. So continuous compounding, it's not actually very continuous because we have a long period of time. We have years here as a frequency of observations. So it's not a very long investment period actually, but the idea of continuous compounding means that you are supposed to invest also your interest yield from the first year to the second year. So in N years, you would get an amount of the $100 times 1 plus I to the power of N. So here's the simple present value idea. If we assume a constant flow of future payments to the investor and we have some interest rates that can be used in valuating those future cash flows, we can calculate the current discounted today's present value. There are many names for this dear child that I love very much. We can calculate the discounted value for the future cash flow payments based on this equation. So if you invest for 10 years at a 10% annual return or annual interest rate, then the constant future cash flows is divided by 1.1 to the power of 10. So can you directly compare payments scheduled in different points in the timeline? No. Basically, it's not possible to do that. So you get these amounts of payments in different times throughout your investment period. So you should be somehow able to calculate present value of these to be able to compare your current investment to the future, current value of the future streams of earnings or payments that you will be getting in the future throughout your investment period. So there are four types of credit market instruments, and for each and every one of these, actually these simple discounting ideas still hold. So there is this simple loan, it pays a principal and interest rate back at the expiry date, and then this fixed payment loan and coupon bonds and discount bonds. And the main difference between the coupon bonds and discount bonds is that these discount bonds are so-called zero coupon bonds. So the only return that you get from this investment is just the price difference. So it's a capital return from change in the price between the investment period and the redemption period, or when the asset matures. So usually these discount bonds have a current price that is lower compared to the time of the redemption value. So the name of discount bond actually comes from that. And the return comes from the difference between the current lower price and the higher price in the redemption, time of redemption of this asset. So one important thing that is different from interest rate is yield to maturity. It's basically like an interest rate, but it's not the general market interest rate. It's the interest rate on this specific asset that you are interested about in investing. It equates the present value of cash flow payments received from a debt instrument with its value today. So basically, it's the yield to maturity that you are calculating based on this equation. And for simple loans, the simple interest rate equals the yield to maturity. But that is the only case when the actual interest rate and yield to maturity are the same. In the case of fixed payment loan, you have these fixed yearly payments that can be, for example, in the form of coupons for bonds. And you get those payments each and every year up until the maturity of the loan. So for a 10 years maturity, you get from the first year the fixed payment, the coupon, you discount that and with the interest rate, and the same applies to the last, for example, the coupon from the 10th year of that holding period. So using the same strategy used for the fixed payment loans, you can actually calculate the current price of these coupon bonds also. So you are assuming that you are willing to hold the coupon bond that you are buying from the secondary markets. You can obviously buy that also from the primary markets at the issue of that asset, but you can go and participate to the investments of this asset to the markets in the secondary market. And from that period of time onwards, you have the coupon payments each and every year up until the maturity of that asset. And in that point of time, you will also get the face value of the bond back to you. So that's the redemption value. And you discount all these payment flows to the current value, to the current value based on the interest rate that you observe in the markets. So when the coupon bond is priced at its face value, the yield to maturity equals the coupon rate. The price of a coupon bond can the yield to maturity are negatively related. And this is the thing that you have to understand. We will go through these things in many occasions when we start to discuss about the equilibriums in the interest yielding asset markets through the analysis of supply and demand conditions. But already now, from this simple idea of discounting, you should get the main idea about this. So the yield to maturity is greater than the coupon rate when the bond price is below its face value. So here are some examples of how to calculate a 10% coupon rate bond value and a yield to maturity for this asset in terms of the actual numbers. And you can calculate those based on that equation that we had there. And then there's one form of coupon bonds that is called the console loan or perpetuity, a bond with no maturity date that does not repay principal. So it's a continuum of yearly payments to you only without the redemption payment. So it pays a fixed coupon payment forever to you. So you can also calculate the price or the yield to maturity of the console. Basically, an approximation for that is given by this dividing the yearly interest payment by the price of the console at the moment. So for coupon bonds, this equation gives the current yield, and it's very easy to calculate approximation to the yield to maturity. For any 1 year discount bond, you have this kind of pricing equation going on. So the interest rate on that asset is the face value of the discount bond minus the current price of the discount bond divided by the current price. So this is just the normal relative return that you calculate. Multiply this by 100 and you get the actual percentage interest rate on that, or the yield to maturity. And the yield to maturity equals the increase in price over the year divided by the initial price. And analogous to the coupon bond, the yield to maturity is negatively related to the current bond price. So negative relation comes from the negative coefficient on that one, or negative effect coming from the denominator. And obviously it is negatively related to this yield to maturity through this denominator effect also. So both of these work into opposite direction in terms of the interest rate. And this is a general definition for any kind of assets rate of return. So when you start in your own analysis in the future, you start figuring out what is the actual rate of return for this asset. You should first determine whether that gives you a constant flow of returns. Whether you earn dividends, for example, from investment on stocks, and whether you are promised to be paid, being paid a coupon payment, then the total return comprises of these two components. The fixed coupon payment divided by the current valuation of that asset plus the change in the price relative to the current price of that asset. So this is a general definition for the actual returns. And in case that you are not analyzing, for example, these kind of assets that pay you annual returns, you can obviously approximate the return using logarithmic changes at the prices. Just we will be going through these things in the time series course very carefully, but in usual, in most of the analysis regarding the assets in the secondary market, having a secondary market quotations, we use log returns or log changes in prices as an approximation for the return on that asset. But nevertheless, if you want to calculate exact accurate returns, you can calculate that based on this equation. So the second part here is the rate of capital gain, and the first part is the current value of the coupon payment. So it's a current yield of the near-term payments. So the distinction between interest rates and returns comes here. Return equals the yield to maturity only if the holding period equals the time to maturity. The rise in interest rates is associated with a fall in bond prices, and it results to capital loss if the time to maturity is longer than the holding period. And the longer is the maturity of the bond, the greater the size of the percentage price change associated with an interest rate change. So this is the standard or the normal case for evaluating the interest yielding asset markets or the returns in there. But nowadays we are living in an extreme situation where we observe these negative interest rates. And that actually deserves a separate lecture, completely separate lecture in the or in a couple of weeks time when we does start the discussion about these things. So here is a table about the calculation of the 1 year returns on different maturity 10% coupon rate bonds when interest rates rise from 10% to 20%. This applies that equation there, equation, I didn't number the equation, but that's the equation on slide 76. So it's this one, it's applying this this equation. Okay, so I think we can continue from this, because in this room is going to be a next lecture in the future. So if anyone of you have questions, actually the time is up now, so send the questions through chat, let's say within 2 or 3 minutes, or the other possibility is that you send the questions to me through email if something is not clear in these lectures. And hopefully tomorrow we are able to continue in the same room that we started today, Ake Delta, but if that's not the case, then we will have to switch to the online case again. So thanks for your interest, and see you hopefully tomorrow.
Thank you, goodbye.